Good morning and welcome to episode 80 of the Deck Tease Podcast, brought to you by GatheringMagic.com. My name is Erin Campbell. There are not many people that I would get up at 2 in the morning to record with, but my guest is certainly the exception. He is the German juggernaut. He is a four-time player of the year. He is Kai Bede. Hello.
Hey, Erin. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you.
Good. So I do want to recap. How exactly do I say your last name?
It's Kai Bode.
Buddha.
Yeah, early on everyone was pronouncing it Buddy, but by now it's a bit better.
Okay, so Buddha, like the little round guy.
Yeah, that works.
Okay, because I was going over it today and I was like, well, it's not bidet because that's the little Euro toilet thing. And I don't want to call you that. And
that
it's
would
not
be the French version, maybe, I guess.
And I don't want to call you booty because you're not an ass. So that would be inappropriate. So I was kind of mulling over it and I just realized, oh, crap, I don't know how to say it. So thank you for clearing that up for me.
Yeah, it's one of the few names that Americans usually have problems with.
Yeah.
Most German names are kind of compatible, but that one isn't.
That's true. That's true. And thank you for coming on the show. This is such a big deal for me. I'm a huge fan of yours. I watched you on the recent Pro Tour coverage, and there was a moment where I knew that I had to have you on my show. Do you know what that moment was?
Possibly the game against Hedrick in the last round.
Well, there was that, but I was actually, I have to admit, I wasn't sure about having you on at first, because I know that you can be a little shy or a little quiet, and you're such a big name, and I was kind of going back and forth with it, and I was like, well, I don't really know, like, maybe he won't do it, maybe he won't talk, and I was watching the stream, and all of a sudden, I got a flurry of tweets, and they said, Kai just said fuck on the stream.
I mean,
and I was just like, that's awesome. I have to have
you. Did I? I don't even remember that.
I believe you did.
Okay. Sure.
And people were really excited and they were like, that's the sign you need him on your show. And I was like, he's a pistol. I'm in. So that's why you're here.
Yeah, I mean, the last game, it surely was that game. And that was at times a bit frustrating. Although it was more frustrating for my opponent. So. Mm-hmm.
I did really like your breakdown, though, with Hetrick, though, because I am a Living End fan, and I really appreciate the way that you still showed respect to that matchup, because I feel like a lot of people, underappreciate Living End, or they don't really feel it's a threat, and you seem to really show it some props, so that was cool.
Yeah, I already dropped some points against that deck earlier, so...
Really?
Yeah, French guy drew with me in the second round of Modern or something. Mm-hmm. It was fairly frustrating from my point of view, but happens...
Because I actually have a really tough time against Storm. I was actually dreading playing it, but I'm getting a little better.
Well, the thing with Storm, especially in that tournament, you pretty much always won game one. I think I won game one of my matches 9 times mm-hmm. out of 10 rounds, and I also won that round game one, and then he boarded in 2 slaughter games, I think, mm-hmm. like the new lobotomy that removes target card from your opponent's deck. And then in the second game, he had one for turn four, so I tried to go off turn three, didn't work, and he won. And then the second game, he actually had turn three with Spirit Guides, and then another his second copy turn four, mm-hmm. and removed all my winning conditions. And I mean, I don't know. If you bought in 2 copies of a card, and then you draw it 3 times in 2 games, that's... A little bit above average, I would say.
Yeah. I have to say, the other thing I enjoyed about your article is you brought up the empty the Warrens argument, because I have a couple of friends who play Storm, and I had made a comment about possibly boarding in Leyline of the Void and things like that, and they were like, oh, Erin, I'll just kill you with goblins, and I'm like, well, I can get rid of creatures. Like, that's not a problem.
And yeah, that doesn't seem possible, really.
And you had made this nice comment about how, you know, you're as likely to win with goblins as you're likely to get somebody to not draft blue or something like that.
Yeah, Polish Erin.
I thought that was really cool. And I was like, see, Kai says you can't do it. Ha! So.
I mean, it's not going to work.
I'm glad they know that now. So so let's go ahead and get started. So one of the things that I've noticed about you, Kai, is I did a little bit of research, as I do on all of my guests. And whenever I've seen you in interviews, you always seem a little uncomfortable when people lavish praise on you. Like when they name all of your accomplishments, and they, especially when you tell them what deck they're playing. And it's, you know, oh, that's the best deck ever, Kai. You're the best. You're awesome. And you look like you want to be anywhere but there. Is that really what you're thinking when that's going on?
It's a bit of an awkward situation, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's flattering, of course, but it always seems strange.
Have you ever gotten used to the fame in your time playing the game?
I mean, I don't mind when I'm like at a GP or something, when I have to sign cards or something, or like when I used to play at GPs, there was generally like 15 to 20 people watching, even if it's not a feature match. I mean, I don't mind that at all, but sometimes it gets a bit strange. But I mean, obviously that has stopped by now. I mean, there's usually a couple of people watching, but it's not nearly as it was like 12 years ago or whatever.
Are you almost surprised when people recognize you now because you have been gone a little while or you've cut back a bit?
I mean, not really. I mean, most people that play the PT actually have been playing Magic for like 10 years or something. It's not like you start playing Magic and then you immediately go to the PT. And I don't play GPs anymore. I just can't take that much time off work. At GPs, it would probably happen a bit more. But most people that play on the PT actually know enough about PT history. Like, I had one guy at the last PT ask me where I'm from. But usually they're like, oh, hi, Kai, nice to meet you. So
very cool.
It doesn't happen that much. Like, the one GP I played in Paris like 3 years ago, I think like half of my opponent didn't know who I was. I think it's just a different kind of tournament environment.
Yeah. One of the things I've also noticed about you is that you've gone on record before as saying that you don't necessarily believe that there's such a thing as just the best Magic player. Do you still feel that way?
I mean, you can't even compare it. Mm-hmm. Like, you would need to have two people play over like the same period of 5 years to say this guy is better than this guy. And even then, there's so few Pro Tour matches that it's really tough to compare. And like, comparing Finkel and me is just impossible. We didn't play at the same time. I mean, we played for like 1 or 2 years, but that was John's decline already. Like, John was like, when I started to play, John was clearly the best player in the world. And then when I started to win tournaments, he was already playing, I think, poker or blackjack or something, and he was on his way out. Like, there was 1 year where he took it reasonably serious, and that was strangely also my worst year. Like, in the 5 years I played, that's the 1 year where I didn't win Player of the Year. And that was the 1 year where he actually put effort into it, so it's like pretty tough to compare, I think.
Do you think that you would still feel that way if you weren't considered one of the best? Like, if you were just Kai Buddha, average player, and, you know, you're talking with your friends, and you know how it is sometimes when you're with your friends and you're going to events and you, on the car ride there, you talk about your decks, your strategies, and let's say one of your friends is sitting in the passenger seat and they say, so, who's the best player in the world? Would you still feel that way?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I work in sports betting, so I spend a lot of time, like, adjusting odds and trying to figure out what is better and for what reason. And I mean, I like, there's just no metric in Magic where you can say, okay, this guy is clearly better than this guy. I mean, what you can say is okay, this guy is much better in Constructed than in Limited. But like, I think that's as far as you can get.
You also brought up something really interesting. A lot of times when people talk about you, Kai, they do bring up Finkel. You two are widely seen as the best players of all time, you know, depending on the variables. What is your relationship with him like? Because I know it's been tossed about that there was a little bit of a rivalry there or whatever. Was that ever there?
Not really, because, again, we didn't really play in the same tournaments. When I was playing all of the PTs, and John didn't really care all that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he played some of them, but then he was just only showing up for the PT and wasn't really prepared. So there wasn't much of a rivalry going on at all. And I didn't even know him that much. I mean, back then I was like my first tournament, I was barely 18, I think. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was talking to German guys. I didn't really hang out with any of the Americans or something. So I didn't really have anything to do with him. Actually, now we're on the same team randomly, and we're actually pretty good friends. But back then we just didn't talk.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool that you're friends now. I was just wondering what it would be like, you know, especially when you're being tutored for your accomplishments, and then, you know, and then suddenly this other name keeps coming up. If it were me, I would be like, you know, we're talking about me now. Like, why do you have to share the spotlight? You know, like, I would be a little funny about that, but that's just me. So.
I mean, I think John is pretty similar in that way. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had him on my show as well, and he's just super modest, and I think that he's very gracious about everything that happens to him, and it doesn't seem like he would necessarily mind that either, which is cool.
No, I don't think so. I mean, he's actually also interested in sports betting, and I think if you come from this kind of poker sports betting background, it's pretty easy to see that you can't say this guy is. I mean, you can say this guy is better, but like, eventually you reach a level where you just can't anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say you work in sports betting, what exactly does that mean? Like, what do you do?
It's kind of like financial trading, I would say.
Okay.
I mean, there's markets, and there's odds, there's numbers, and you have to move them around when money comes in, or when you want money on a certain team or something like that.
Okay, because when you said betting, I was imagining, like, you know, when people go to the horses and they pick a horse and they go up to that little booth and pay money. Is that sort of what you do, or no?
No. I'm working for probably the biggest sports betting company, and I'm a trader for them.
Jesus.
And trading pretty much means just like it's similar to day trading in stock market, I think.
Fantastic. It sounds cool. Like, when you say sports betting, it sounds great.
It's a fun job, and there's also like a lot of Magic players working for that company, because the skill set you need for that is risk management, and you can't be afraid of losing money. I mean, you're just not going to win all the time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can't really learn. Like, there's no, like, if you studied math at university, that's like a good foundation, I guess. But if you played Magic or Poker, that's probably much better. I mean, at least if you played it at a high level. So there's quite a few Magic players working for that company.
I also thought it was really interesting that you moved into that field, Kai, because so often I've had a couple of Hall of Famers on my show, not to brag, and it's very common perception that they either go to work for Wizards or they go into some form of game design, and that's sort of the end step. And I always find it interesting when pros decide they don't want to go there, that they want to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I could work in game design. I mean, I could certainly work in game balancing. I'm pretty sure I would be very good at this. But, like, designing new stuff, I don't think that would be something I would be very good at.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the way that Wizards is going with Magic right now. That wouldn't be the game I would want to design, I don't think.
I do want to ask you about that, because I know John's gone on record as sort of saying that, you know, he likes to muse about where the game is right now and how the decks just aren't how they used to be. Like, he likes to think of decks in Modern, and like, he'll look at decks in Standard and say, this isn't Control, this isn't what I know. Do you kind of feel the same way in terms of how, like, what mid-range is today versus what it used to be, and so on and so forth?
Well, the block constructed and Standard formats are generally bigger is better right now. Like, mm-hmm. every turn you need to hit your drop and you need to cast something very powerful. Like, there's insane high-end stuff like Azaling, Bloodburn, Sphinx Revelation. The Wrath of God is even uncounterable, so, like, that's not exactly good for mid-range creature decks.
Mm-hmm.
And that used to be completely different. And, I mean, you can easily see the breaking point where Aaron Forsyth took over from Randy Bueller for R&D.
Mm-hmm.
Randy would have designed the game. Like, if Randy was in charge, the game would be a lot more in the direction of chess, I would say. Like, it would be... It wouldn't be that many haymakers and stuff,
yeah.
But overall for Magic, it seems to be good. I mean, the player numbers and stuff are going up. Like, I think it's worse for, like, professional play, but, I mean, in the end, professional play only exists because there is a huge base of players, so it's probably going into the correct direction. But, I mean, you can easily see where the game changed. It was, like, around the time of Onslaught, I think,
mm-hmm.
like, and from there on, the sets started to be very different mm-hmm. from previous sets.
Yeah, I was actually at GP Richmond this past weekend, huge turnout, and I happened to see a Twitter discussion going on, I think you were a part of it, where they were talking about the cap, the GP cap.
No, at least I didn't participate in that, I don't think.
Okay.
Like, someone brought up on Twitter, basically Sam Black and Shui were complaining that there's no incentive for them to go to GPs. Like, they want to play Magic, but there's no real incentive for them to go to GPs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they get, like, their five GPs that count for PT points.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some discussion about that. I mean, the problem is, 15 years ago, I would go to the GP because obviously I want to have fun, but
yeah.
Sam would go to have fun as well. But, like, the incentive for me was also to win money.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would go to this 500-player tournament, and I would have a reasonable chance to top 8, and top 8 would break even, and then anything be above that, I would be winning money. But suddenly now, the GPs have, I don't know, 2,500 players instead of 500 players, and the payout hasn't really changed.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, I mean, if there ever was any EV, I'm not sure if there was ever any value going to GPs, but if there was any, it's been dissipated now.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, like, a small incentive with the pro points, but now that that's out of the equation, it's basically telling the pro players go to exactly 5 GPs in which you made proto points and then stop playing GPs. And Sam was complaining about that. There's points for both sides there. I mean, obviously, you would want Sam and Shui to go to every GP if they have the time. But if you fully, like, either you have to raise the payout, so they would want to go for the payout. But then, I mean, if Wizards didn't raise payout in the last 20 years, I would say they're not really interested in raising the payout. And then the other choice is to make a bridge with the PT point payout. But the problem with that is that, in general, you cannot really make a living off Magic.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine to play Magic full-time while you're a student or for a couple of years. But eventually, if you think about a family or something, you're not going to be able to play Magic professionally. I mean, you can maybe if you have something on the side, like a card shop, or write a lot of articles or something, but the pure money that's in the Magic Proto Circle is not nearly enough to play that professionally. And then Wizards will want that people have a job on the side but can still play Magic professionally.
Mm-hmm.
But now if you remove that 5 GP cap, then that kind of pushes them out. Because then you would have to raise the threshold for that Platinum rank where you get your flights paid and stuff.
Yeah.
And if you raise that payout, then this is hardly possible to reach for people that have a full-time job and can't afford to go to a GP every second weekend or something because you just don't have the time for it. So it's a bit of a problem for Wizards of the Coast. I mean, they want that LSV and Kibler and all those guys can play professionally and have a reasonable shot at reaching platinum, but they also want that Sam and Shuey go to every GP. I would guess that they want that at least. And finally, I mean, obviously the easiest solution is would be to throw more money at the GP payout, but I mean that obviously costs them a lot of money, and yeah, I mean it's a bit of a problem. I mean, there's good arguments for both sides, really.
That
Like
was something I'm sorry.
I would certainly like to see Sam playing in every GP, but I also want that LSV can have a job and still play Magic full time and go to every Pro Tour.
Yeah, those
So.
are things I learned very early on. The first Hall of Famer I had on my show was Darwin Castle, and they used to, on the Hall of Fame profiles, they used to list how much money that person had made throughout their career, and it looks really impressive. Like you're seeing numbers like 200,000, 300,000, and I remember going into Darwin's interview and going, "So Darwin, you're really rolling in it, huh?" And Darwin was like, "No."
Yeah, exactly. You just don't. I mean, my career winnings, I mean, maybe approaching to 400,000 now or something, but that's over like a gigantic period of time. Like back when I was studying, that was fine. I won like $300,000 in like 4 or 5 years. That's good enough if you're studying and there's some money. There's like I got most of my flights paid because I was player of the year and stuff. So I definitely made money. Like I know that I made money. I came out ahead of that. But like then I was the biggest winner by far. So you just can't make a living off it, I don't think.
And there's all the hidden costs. Like I said, Darwin explained, sometimes there's your travel, there's your hotel. If you happen to not make that money back at the event, you're technically, operating at a loss. And then there's the personal side of things. I remember Kibler wrote a post a couple years ago where he's like, I haven't done laundry in a week. Like, I haven't seen my family. I had Jackie Lee on my show during her heyday, and she was like, "Yeah, my husband, he tweets me to know where I am because I don't know where I am at any given point." And just those little sacrifices that go into that that I don't think people see when they see that $300,000. Or they see that there's those little costs they don't think about.
Yeah, exactly. Also, like the traveling is actually a big problem. I mean, back then I just didn't care, but like last year for PT San Diego, I had to take what like 10 days off work, so I have 7 vacation days or something. In a usual work week, I work about 40 to 45 hours, I guess, and I spent 40 hours between airplanes and airports in that
Jesus.
1 week of vacation time I took. Like the full time I would be sitting in the office, I was sitting in airplanes, and I mean that's not really a trade-off I want to do more often than once a year. I mean it's fine for European events, but like, I mean I'm probably going to all the US events this year, but that's not something I can do every season.
You said something interesting in the recent article that you wrote for Channel Fireball. You indicated that you once held the title of worst complainer after losing in a very unrealistic scenario.
Well, I mean, I don't think I go on tilt or anything and play verse. Like I'm very good at just putting that aside, but like I certainly am prone to complaining too much. I'm pretty
Really?
sure I've yeah, I'm quite of bad at that. Like once I actually burned part of a deck because I was so annoyed. I mean that I don't know. I think I actually mentioned that to someone else. So there was this European Championship where they just made a new set and they fucked up pretty big time. They printed a creature that when it dies, you mill your deck from the top until you hit the next creature, and then you put that into play. And then there was another creature. When it comes into play, it grabs an enchantment from your graveyard and puts it on top of it. And then you were playing four of the first creature, one of that, and then you had four abductions in your deck, which is meant to be a control magic, but it also has a side effect that when the creature dies, it goes back to its owner's control, which was meant as a backdraw for, like, they tried to make control magic fair. So if you control magic my creature and I then kill it on your side, it comes back on my side of the board. But the problem with that was you only needed a sacrifice outlet and that first creature, and then you had a two card combo to win. Like the sacrifice outlet was a when you sacrifice a creature, it doesn't cost any mana. You mill your opponent for cards equal to the power. So if you had the first creature and that on play, you would sacrifice it, go through your deck to find either the next gamekeeper or that Drake that brings the enchantment back, and then you only need to mill your like while you mill your deck, you only need to hit one of your four of those control magics, and then when the Drake comes back, it takes that control magic, brings it back into play, and that's an infinite loop with the sacrificing. Like you sacrifice the Drake to mill your opponent, then the abduction triggers, brings it back, and then the Drake brings back the abduction. So basically, without realizing it, they printed a two-card combo, and that standard format back then had City of Traitors, Ancient Tomb, Mox Diamond, Intuition, and Vampiric Tutor. So they printed an insane, like, I mean, it just killed turn three in standard. Like they had to actually. I don't know if they banned or erated the cards a week after the tournament, but it was just actually disgusting. Dirk made the finals with that deck, and I somehow managed to go 4-3 in the tournament with it, which is, I mean, the deck was just so overpowered it was not even funny. And in the last match against a good friend of mine, I won the first game, and then in the second game, my opponent was playing mono blue. He had no permanence on turn four, and I had one part of my combo, and a scroll I can play, and I lost that game. And then in the third game, again, he had no permanence on turn four because I boiled his islands. And then once again, I couldn't find the second part of my combo until he killed me like turn 15. And after that, I was so mad that I actually burned most of the cards. Like I think I saved like the most diamonds because I didn't want to burn like a $20 note or something. But I was furious, to say the least. And that happens sometimes. I mean, when I drew with the French guy at the last PD, I was I didn't know at that point that he had two slaughter games, that he only had two slaughter games. I kind of expected four because he drew one in game two and then two in game three. But then Raphael Levy was playing the same deck and he told me that he only had two. And I was like, okay. I mean, the match was at 4-0. So, I mean, winning that one would have been pretty nice.
And it's funny because going back to my friends who play Storm, I had mentioned putting slaughter games into my sideboard because I had heard what they did. And again, all of my Storm friends were like, oh, Aaron, it's too slow. It's not going to do anything. And I was like, but Kai said it did something against him, you guys. It's going to work. And I'm actually trying slaughter games this weekend because of what happened. So
I don't think it's very good, really. Like, the problem is that you need two and you need to resolve two.
True.
Like, I bought it in two lightning bolts, which is more than enough, because if you go off with an ascension, you just draw your deck and play more ascensions and select them up, and then you bolt the opponent and then flash it back with Path and Flames. You probably only need even one bolt, I would guess. And Storm is a turn 3, turn 4 combo deck, and you would want to name a kill condition with it, so you would have to resolve it on turn 4 and 5, and you need to draw 2. I mean, I don't know, but the Black Bridge or whatever that thing is called, Leyland of the Void, that seems a lot better. Like, that was way more scary out of Michael Hedrick's sideboard.
So I shouldn't use slaughter games.
I mean, maybe against other combo decks, but not against Storm, I don't think.
Okay, if Kai Buddha says so, I won't do it. Just, I will not dispute you.
I mean, I wasn't afraid of the first. Like, the first didn't matter at all to me. And then having to resolve two seems unrealistic.
Now, I do have a question about you burning the deck now, just because I'm curious. Did you light up the cards one at a time, or did you, like, you know, set a fire and throw them in? Like, break that down.
We were just at dinner, and, like, there was, like, a small fireplace, and that was pretty convenient to just put them all in there.
That's fantastic.
I mean, like, actually everyone else went 6-1 or better with the deck, and... Yeah, not too happy about it.
I'll have to remember that because I have a bit of a tilting issue, and I've gotten a little better in recent months, but I know that there have been people who have mentioned it, and at least this way I can be like, at least I'm not burning decks, you guys. Like, I've come a long way. Like, I might tell you to, you know, go step on Legos barefoot, but at least I didn't burn my deck. Like, I have a line right there.
I mean, the good part for me is that I only do it after the tournament, really. Like, during a tournament when I can still, when I'm still playing for something, I'm not that bad. I mean, I definitely go I go into a lower gear if I can't play for top 8 anymore. Like, when I lost in Valencia and I was knocked out of top 8 contention, the next match I actually played pretty badly, but I mean, that's like maybe one game or something, and then I pick myself up again. But yeah, I'm prone to telling bad beat stories, I think.
Well, with that accent, I mean, I can't think of anybody who wouldn't want to hear a bad beat story. Just saying.
I mean, to be fair, in general, I think bad beat stories in Magic are kind of miserable. I mean, sometimes they're funny, obviously, but most of them are like, yeah, double mulligan, then didn't draw lands. So that's not very interesting to hear, I don't think.
Yeah, that's something I definitely think about. Like, there have been, and I think that's part of the reason why I tilt, and I think I went over this with Chapin when I had him on, is, you know, I had made a comment about that I lost in a really embarrassing way, and Chapin had sort of put me on the therapist couch and was like, well, why do you say that? And I was like, well, what was I going to tell people, that this happened and this happened? And he was like, why does it matter? He's like, you know, you don't owe people a great heroic story about why you won or why you lost. It's simply, I lost or I won. It doesn't have to be like that. And I feel like a lot of my embarrassment comes down to, what am I going to tell people when I tell them that I lost to this card? And then I realize that's all kind of bullshit and it doesn't matter.
So. Yeah, I try to force myself to just say, yeah, I lost. Yeah. And not like tell the details of why I lost, because, I mean, if it's funny, sure, but like most of the time it just isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in Limited, if your opponent played like a rare or something and beat you with it, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
No one really cares. It happens.
Right. One of the things I really enjoyed, or I noticed about your Channel Fireball post as well, is that while you were testing with Pantheon, you seemed to take a almost nurturing role with the guys. Like you had mentioned that you did the cooking, and you had mentioned that it was beautiful outside. You took a picture, and you said that you were trying to get them to go outside rather than stay cooped up all day. Are you naturally that nurturing of a person, or does it just come out when you're testing?
That's probably because of the general attitude of in that group. I mean, some of them are really bad when it comes to that. I mean, I didn't ask them to go outside. I just wanted to play outside myself instead of just being like the sixth match at that kitchen table. And the cooking, I mean, I'm not a great cook or anything. And then if you cook for 15 people, you're also kind of limited. I mean, it's not like I ever do that. So, I mean, it's kind of coming down to like steaks or barbecue chicken and various kinds of potatoes and vegetables, but like nothing fancy or anything. But I think Sam Black is a strictly better cook than I am, actually. But he's vegan, I think. He might be just vegetarian. But if he's only vegetarian, he's pretty aggressive about it, at least. And so that was out of the question for a whole week. And then I was the only one left, I think. And then, like, also, we were, like, the house was really nice, but it was very far off anything. So we only had two cars. So just driving somewhere to go for dinner wasn't an option.
I have to say, that was the question my listeners wanted to know more than anything, is what did he cook?
Nothing exciting, unfortunately, no.
And especially my female listeners, they were like, cute accent cooks. Sold. So your stock definitely went up with the girls, just saying.
Great.
So I want to go back a little bit to your childhood, because I feel like we don't know very much about you and your past. You grew up in Germany.
Yeah.
What were you like as a kid?
Well, first of all, I'm living in Hamburg right now, but I grew up in Cologne, which is, I mean, maybe American tourists know it from a very big church from a couple hundred years ago. I grew up, I mean, my parents divorced at somewhere around 14 or 15 or something, but I could survive with that rather well, I think. And then, well, I have a sister, which is like 1.5 years younger than I am. And then my father remarried, and there's two more children, which are like 13 and 50 now, I think. Yeah, I mean, that's about it. Nothing overly exciting. I started to play Magic in high school. I was playing some, I think it was like Dungeons and Dragons or something. Played that for like half a year or something, and those guys were playing Magic too, so they told me how to play Magic. I wasn't really interested in those role-playing games, other than that there were some girls in that role-playing group, but yeah, so
Kai.
so I stopped that and started to play Magic, and I was a bit lucky because there was a group of very good Magic players back then in Cologne. One of them was one of the first Europeans to win a PT event, I think, like 1997 or something. Yeah, and I mean, I started to play with those guys, and I mean, if you want to, like, if you want the fast track to getting better at Magic, you need to play with a lot better Magic players, and that's what I had. And then eventually Dirk Babrowski moved to Cologne to do his civil service. And he was pretty much doing nothing but that civil service stuff, playing some soccer and playing Magic. So we played a lot of Magic. Like basically, whenever I came off school, I would meet Dirk somewhere. We would either play some soccer or go straight to playing Magic, and we would be playing a lot of Magic. Eventually, Marco Blume came. I mean, we knew him from playing Magic, but then he moved to Cologne for studying. Obviously, it was back in his head that we are good friends and he wanted to play more Magic. And then we just had a very good group there. I mean, Magic Online started to exist a couple of years later, and there was like Apprentice or something else. But if you wanted to be good at Magic back then, you needed a good local group. I mean, like most of the good American players were from the New York area, John Finkel, Stephen O'Mahony Schwartz, because they were playing at that Neutral Ground store. I mean, that's how it worked back then. Like, you needed a good local group. Like, the good French people were, the good European people were mostly from Paris. Yeah, and I mean, I had that group there. And I mean, it was kind of interesting because it was not, we didn't know how good we were because you couldn't compare it to other people. I mean, we did okay at the European GPs. We played a couple and we did all right. Like, the top 8 one, I think, and I finished in the money most of the time. And then eventually we played our first PT together. In Chicago, and we were like, yeah, we have no idea how this is going. I mean, we've been preparing at home, and there's not much stuff like internet. I mean, it existed back then, but it was mostly newsgroup stuff. It's quite a while ago. Yeah, and then we played the PT, and it just felt a lot easier than we expected it to be. Like Dirk won, and I finished in the top 16. And yeah, from there on, it kind of took off then. I mean, kept playing a lot and went to more tournaments and did pretty well.
It sounds like you knew from a very early age, Kai, that you wanted to play Magic competitively, that it wasn't just a game for you. Would you agree with that?
I'm probably very competitive in about anything I do. I mean, it's not always an advantage. Yeah, I actually played a lot of soccer back then, like 5 times a week, and then a match on the weekend, and that was in league play. But I mean, I was okay at that, but I was never really good enough to excel at that or anything. And then I just tried to do I just moved on pretty much. Like, I did that for 11 years, and then at Magic I felt like, okay, I'm pretty good at this, so I'm having fun and I'm winning, so let's try this, how this is working out.
So are you saying that there's pictures out there somewhere of a little Kai in a soccer uniform?
I mean, that was like, what, 1995 or something? Like, if that was today, sure, you would find pictures somewhere online, but back then, I don't think that existed. I mean, there were no digital cameras, I'm pretty sure, so.
I bet you were adorable in your soccer uniform, just throwing that out there.
Hopefully.
So what did your family think about this? Like, did you actually sit them down and say, Mom, Dad, I'm going to play competitive Magic? Because I know a lot of parents, they may not be okay with that, or they may go, what is this? What's this game? Why are you doing this? How did that go down?
Well, playing games, first of all, especially, I mean, back then you were pretty much forced to learn English by playing Magic, and that was okay. But going to tournaments and stuff, my mother is a teacher at a high school, or was a teacher, she just retired actually. She was not happy that, I mean, I had mostly pretty good grades in school, but for example, in Germany, you have one final exam when you have a high school, and from there you can either go to work right away or you go to university. But that high school exam is, it's not super important, but like, you need reasonably good grades if you want to pick the university you're studying at. And there's f your four main classes, and there's a final exam in each of them, which it makes up like 40% of your grade or something like that. And unfortunately, there was a pro tour event in New York between two of the final exams. Like, there was one on Tuesday and one on the next Wednesday, and there was the pro tour in New York on the weekend in between. And I definitely wanted to play that. My teacher was fine with it because my grades were good enough, but my mother was not very excited about it. I kind of managed to push that through, and it was super important because I finished somewhere in the top 20 or something, and that gave me enough points to then pass John on Player of the Year in that season after the next tournament. So I was very happy that I went, but I actually, like, we have our grades are 6 through 1, and 1 is the best grade. And I actually had a 2 in math in that final exam, and that was like the first time I didn't have a 1, I was like. So I definitely killed my final grade a bit when I mean, it's nothing important. Like, that grade, actually, no one ever asked that again after you're done with university, so it's a bit overrated. But anyway, yeah, my mother had her problems with it. My father actually thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah,
Yeah,
very proud of you.
definitely. I mean, he's a bit more, I mean, just do what you want to do. It's going to work out anyway if you're smart enough. So my mother really wanted to push, like, all right, finish school, do civil service as fast as possible, and then do university as fast as possible. Like, she was definitely coming from that direction. And my father was more like, nah, if you want to take like 1 or 2 years off playing Magic, whatever, do it.
So you're talking a little bit about your history, Kai, and how you got started. And according to your Hall of Fame profile and Wikipedia, you won your first PTQ in 97 for the second Pro Tour ever in New York. And then from then on, your career becomes a bit of a blur. There's Grand Prix titles, you're named Pro Player of the Year, World Champion, and then you had your first decline in 99 to 2000. What was going through your mind at that time, where you're racing up the charts, you're doing your thing, and then there's that lull? Like, what are you thinking at that time? Like, are you thinking it's over? Are you thinking you can come back? Like, what goes through your mind when you have a decline?
No, I just wasn't really interested anymore. I mean, like, the main reason I was doing all that well and had so much fun was that Dirk and Marco were doing everything. But like, at that point, everyone around me quit Magic. Like, I was the only one. I mean, all the other guys were in, like, they were like, what, 24, 25 at that point. And I mean, you had to finish university and find a job. I mean, obviously for me it was okay because I was making that much money, but for the others it just wasn't. Like, Marco and Dirk both, like, Dirk was running a travel agency back then and didn't have that much time anymore. And Marco was working in IT somewhere. And then the other guys in Hamburg, like Christian Lewis, Patrick Mello, they all of them quit because they just didn't think. I mean, they had still had fun playing Magic, but they didn't bring in enough money to to keep doing that. And then there was the poker stuff coming up, and just like everyone around me that I was playing with just actually went out of the game. I mean, I was spending a lot of time playtesting with a group of Swedish guys, Jens Toren, Anton Jonsson, Matthias Ketzil, and Matthias Jorstedt. And like just all of those guys quit at once. They were all just like gone from one PT to the other. And I mean, that pretty much killed my motivation.
So it sounds like you do enjoy the social aspect or the collaborative aspect. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we were always playtesting with roughly the same group. And then I would go to a PT, but I would not be really prepared for it. And then I didn't do well. And I mean, again, I'm very competitive. I mean, I had fun playing there. But like, if I feel like I can't win, then I just then I don't have fun anymore. And I did that like twice or something, just preparing with like local guys that won PTQs here. And I just realized that, that's not what I want to do. And yeah, then I just stopped going to PT events as well.
Would you say that you don't have as much fun without your friends there?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So during the 2001-2002 season, speaking of your friends, Dirk and Marco, you enlisted them to form a team called the Phoenix Foundation. You three ended up becoming the most successful team in Pro Tour history. And you could have worked with anybody you wanted to. Why did you choose those two?
Well, first of all, Dirk and me played the previous PT together already with third guy André Constanze, who used to be very good, like probably the best German player back then actively. Like, he didn't make many PT top 8s, but he had a string of top 16 finishes, so just always one match close. And we did pretty well at that team PT, like one match out of top 4 or something, and then André kind of quit, and it was only logical to play with Marco. I mean, Dirk and me both had the experience already. Like, we did, I think we both had our PT wins already at that point. And Marco was like very good and qualified for mostly everything. So that was, I mean, the team format is just so much more about preparation. I mean, it's not like in Rochester draft, maybe we would be like 65%, 70% to win a match. And then in Team Rochester, we were suddenly like 90% or something to win. I mean, we just hardly ever lost. And that's not because we were that much better. That was just because we were that much better prepared. Like, a lot of people were just preparing online on Magic Online or NetDraft Apprentice for PTs, and you just couldn't do that. Like, you actually had to... I mean, basically, what we did back then is what all the big teams do right now. Like, meet up, like, 2 weeks before the event and just playtest a lot. And we did that back then already for the team PTs. We would usually, like, I think two or three times we were in Atlanta because Dirk actually lives there part-time of the year. And then we would be playing with local guys like Joe Crosby and I think Mike Ron was actually there. Well, I'm not really sure, but like local good players that Dirk knew. And then sometimes Dutch people were showing up. And I think one time we were in New Jersey with Eugene Harvey and Osip. And I mean, we just would play Team Orchesters for like, or Team Seals as well for the 2 weeks before going into the event. And then most other people just didn't prepare. They were like, ah, we just do Rochester drafts online or like normal drafts and it will be fine. But I mean, that's not how it works out.
Do you think that that was the only reason the team worked so well, is the fact that you prepared well, or was there something, was there another secret to that success?
I mean, we know each other very well. We are all very good Magic players, but I mean, in the end, if we had the same preparation, we would maybe be slight favorites over other good teams. But with that amount of preparation we did and the others not doing anything, yeah, then we were very big favorites.
Do you still talk to them?
What, to Marco and Dirk?
Yeah.
Oh, they work for the same company.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
That's very cool that you're able to sort of trace your history with those guys.
Yeah, I mean, definitely in contact with them a lot. Dirk's actually getting married this summer.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. You're not like burning any decks at his wedding, are you? Just
No, probably not. It's probably going to be some Magic involved, though. Lots of Magic players are coming, I think.
Fantastic. I remember I went to a wedding a couple months ago for a friend of mine who used to work for Wizards, and they had drafts at their wedding. And I remember and all of the tables had Magic names. So there was like, you know, you're sitting at the new Phyrexia table, or you're sitting at the Chandelier table. And they even went so far as to have their vows and a pack of Magic.
Okay, that's not happening at the wedding. I'm pretty positive.
Kai's like, I'm not going if that's happening.
Oh, I'm not even, like, his wife probably knows what Magic is, but I don't think she plays or ever played, or I don't think that's a possibility.
Understandable. So from then on, you have a staggering number of achievements. You have 5 Pro Tour titles in 2 years. You're Pro Tour Player of the Year. You win the DCI Invitational. You have a card made in your image. How do you keep your head on straight through this time? Like, you have a whirlwind of success. How did you stay grounded throughout all that?
I mean, obviously, I don't know what my win percentage in top 8 games was back then, but I think it was exceeding 85%. And I mean, it's not very tough to realize that that's not a real number. I mean, maybe you can have like 70% or something, but you just can't win them every time. So, I mean, I knew that I was just getting lucky, essentially. Like, I don't think I was getting lucky to make those top eights because I was actually well prepared and was probably one of the better Magic players in every tournament. But winning them all, it's just on the lucky side.
But you had to realize that you were doing things that nobody else has done. Like, for example, you're, I think, the only person to date that has won back-to-back Pro Tours. That's a big deal.
It's also a bit like that is kind of made up because I think Randy Bühler or someone came up with that. The thing is that there was a pro tour, there was a world championship in between those two pro tours. And I mean, if you ask any professional player, world championship is just a pro tour. But like officially, it's called pro tour and then world championship. And like I won one in Barcelona in like May or June, and then there was a world championship, and then I won in September or October. So it's a bit far-fetched to say that I won back-to-back PTs, but yeah. I
Interesting.
mean, obviously, like, I mean, I was running well. I think I was playing well. I mean, everything felt pretty easy. I have to admit that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be in that headspace. Because, like I said, that's you were not only at the top, you were past the top. I mean, that was a big deal.
But back then, it was also, I mean, especially in probably also in limited, it was so much easier to be ahead of the pack. Like being much better than the average Magic player in those tournaments was so much easier back then if you prepared properly.
Really?
Like there was much less on the internet. I mean, there was multiple tournaments where we just had the best deck. Like where we straight up just okay, I'm just winning against everyone else, and like hardly anyone else plays the deck in the tournament. Like there was one tournament where we had the Illusion Stone Age deck that was just so much better than like other people were just playing like I don't know, one mana, one once that you could pay a red and pay a life to deal one damage to another creature or something. And I was just playing this mono blue combo deck with like a solid card draw engine, a 2-card kill that gives you 20 life, force of will and counter spell. Like it just didn't really feel like we were playing in the same tournament. And then there was another tournament where everyone was playing Rebels. And the most important card was a card that gives all your creatures protection white, so you could just attack past the other rebels. And then a lot of other people were just playing two of those. And we had four, and then we were the only guys in the whole tournament that had a card that actually stops the other guy from doing that to you. And then I think we had three people in the top eight out of like eight playing that deck. And I mean, that just doesn't happen these days anymore. I mean, everyone has. I mean, for one block constructed PT, Sam Black came up with his Hexproof deck, which no one really had, and that we had two people in the top eight with that. But like this stuff just happened so much more frequently back in the days than it does today. And so, and then also before Magic Online, like preparing for limited tournaments was actually super tough for most people. All they could do was play with your local Friday Night Magic crowd, and I mean, obviously these guys are terrible. And then if you have like a group, like in Hamburg, we had a group of like, I don't know, eight people that were playing every PT or something, and then there was a lot of other good people. So like our preparation was just so much better, I think. It was just like but today you can just log on Magic Online and play those 8-4 drafts, and I mean, obviously it's not as good as the PT drafts, but I'm not even sure. Like some of those 8-4 drafts feel a lot tougher than the first PT draft. So, like it's just so much easier to practice for a PT these days. You can't really compare it, I don't think.
So I want to clarify what you had said because I want to make sure that people have their facts straight. So I'm looking at your Wikipedia page and that there's a link to the Pro Tour events. And so you won the Pro Tour September 7th through the 9th of 2001 with your team. And then there was the Pro Tour immediately after it, November 2nd through the 4th. You won that one. So
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. If you count that, then I won back-to-back PTs. Yeah, but let me just open that page as well. Well, the first thing, like, it was brought up first about individual PTs, and that was 2001 Pro Tour Barcelona Limited, May 4th to 6th, and then
There was something in Toronto after that.
Yeah, exactly. There was a World Championship in Toronto, and then I won the following Pro Tour in New Orleans, 2001, 2002. And, like, essentially, that was if you only look at Pro Tour events, I won back-to-back individual Pro Tours in Barcelona and New Orleans. Like, there was only a team event and the World Championship in between. So, like, if you look purely at Pro Tour events, I won back-to-back individual ones. But there was a lot of stuff going on in between.
Well, at the end of the day, though, you still won 5 individual pro tours. That's still
oh,
awesome.
I'm not complaining, and I mean, it seems very unlikely that anyone will ever match that, because, I mean, it's just there's so much. I mean, the field is just the playing field is so much more even now that for someone to win that, I mean, maybe John, but he would certainly need another 10 years or something.
So speaking of your card, the card they had made in your image was Void Maid Prodigy. I had read somewhere that the art was considered unflattering and that they commissioned new art when it was reprinted. Was any of that your doing? Like, did you have a way to say that? That's not me, guys.
No.
No, okay.
No. I mean, I was very unhappy with the card, but, like, I've never really looked at artwork. It's kind of funny because now that I play on Magic Online, I don't know the card names that well anymore, and I can identify everything by artwork. Mm-hmm. But, like, back then, most of my playtesting was done either with proxy cards or on Apprentice and Netdraft. And back then, I just only knew the card names. Mm-hmm. And I don't play Magic for the fantasy card game or something. Mm-hmm. I look at it like as a poker or chess or whatever. I couldn't really care less about the pictures. Obviously, that's my picture, but I certainly didn't complain. Like, my main point, my main problem with that card was that the card was just terrible. They could have given me something playable. I mean, this was just disgustingly bad compared to other Invitational winner cards. And you didn't really have anything to do with the design yourself. Mm. Basically, when you entered the Invitational, before the tournament started, everyone had to submit a card. Mm-hmm. So they could put the cards on the webpage. And that was just a race to whoever could up with the most overpowered stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like, people were just giving them, like, insane stuff. Like, I think the card that I submitted was an enchantment for 1 blue mana. Your opponent would play with his hand face open, and then you could sacrifice it for 1 blue to draw a card, or sacrifice it for 2 blue to counter target spell. Mm-hmm. Which is, like, strictly better than counter spell, and completely retarded in most combo decks, because... Or also against combo decks, because you couldn't count, like, the counter effect would be coming from a permanent, so you can't counter it back. Obviously, that would never make it to print, but that wasn't the intention. Just everyone was turning in, like, overpowered stuff. And then they would take that card and then make something out of it. It wasn't necessarily even related to the card. And the problem was that they couldn't really talk to you much about it without giving you... information about the sets. Like, maybe they would do it these days because they also give out that god book to some people and just let them sign, like, some NDA or whatever that's called. But back then, they just didn't talk to you at all because they didn't want to reveal set mechanics or something. Mm-hmm. And then you just saw the done card, and, like, the card that they printed for me was just terrible. I mean, there was lots of ways to make such a card playable, but they didn't really. And then, for example, do you know what Chris Pecula turned in as a card?
Meddling Mage? Yeah.
Yes. Do you know what he turned in?
I do not know.
Okay, the card that Chris turned in was blue-blue-1 for 2/3 creature. When it comes into play, you name a card, and then when that card is being played, you can sacrifice it to counter it. Mm-hmm. So he turned in, like, a card that would be barely playable, and they made Meddling Mage out of it. So it was, like, just a big lottery with what would happen to your Invitational card. Like, for some people... something amazing came out of it, and for others, just something unplayable. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've always been a bit annoyed that my card ended in the unplayable pile.
Oh, well, I have to say, I'm looking at the artwork right now, and I actually don't like the Time Spiral art. I feel like the Time Spiral art, they put a couple pounds on you, like you're looking a little healthy in that picture. The Onslaught one, I think the Onslaught one represents you better. Like, it's got your build from what I've seen of you. It just, you get the wind blowing through your hair. I like that one better.
I don't even, the Onslaught one was the first one, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I think the main problem was the gigantic belt on that card. That's what people were a bit complaining. Literally, I wasn't complaining about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I wasn't a huge fan of it or anything, but seemed good enough. Like, I was annoyed with the card itself, but...
Mm-hmm. I like the belt. It's very wrestling champion. Like, rah! And you're doing, like, your...
It does look a bit like a world championship belt or something. Yeah.
The other one looks kind of Jonah Hill-like. Like, I don't really... I don't know. I don't think you're that curvaceous. I think the other one's more you, so...
Yeah, then this big pink bubble or whatever it is. And, I don't know.
Moving on. So 2003 and 2004, you experienced a bit of a decline again, which led to people considering you as being retired from Magic. What made you decide to take a step back from the competitive play?
Well, that was just what I mentioned earlier. Like, everyone around me quit, and then I went to a couple of tournaments without being prepared well enough, and then I just didn't want to go to the next one without being properly prepared, but I also didn't want to put in the same amount of time I did earlier because I just didn't have anyone I wanted to do that with. I mean, I could have maybe asked like Nassif or some of the other French guys, but I didn't even know those guys that much back then. So there was just no one I wanted to prepare with. And I mean, I had done this for 5 years and it felt like, that's it. Mm-hmm. Time to move on.
You said in an interview I found on a website that when people see you on the stage again, they like to use the words comeback and things like that. And you're very quick to sort of dismiss that. So do you consider yourself retired, or how do you consider yourself?
I mean, I was retired. I mean, this season I'm actually playing. I've played the first two PT events and I've actually prepared with the Channel Fireball team. Mm-hmm. So I actually was there like 10 or 14 days in advance and played a lot. I've not done that for previous tournaments. Like in previous years, I've played like one tournament a year, and that was either the World Championship or the PT in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I was not preparing for those at all. Like for one, I just grabbed the deck from Zvi and like he kind of tricked me into playing this terrible... it was like some deck with a white enchantment that gives +2/+2 to all artifacts.
I think I know that one.
But that was like before the deck was actually good. Like they printed one or two more sets with good cards for that deck. Mm-hmm. And that card had like Vector Esp. It was like 1 mana, 1/1 with no abilities. Mm-hmm. And that deck was just actually terrible. I don't know. I think Sam Black actually did well with it, but everyone else got crushed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't prepare for those. Like I was reading the cards in Limited in one of the tournaments. It started with a draft, or like day two was a draft, and it was like, count your pack. And I'm like, yeah, judge, my pack has 14 cards. And then everyone else was like, yeah, that's normal now. I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, that's how much I was prepared back then. And then I was definitely retired, but you can't really say that I'm retired for this season because I'm actually preparing a lot. I mean, I'm not playing all that much Magic. There's a couple of local shops around here, but... sitting in a card shop with 15-year-olds, I don't know, that's past my time, actually. And there's no really good local tournaments or anything. So I'm mainly playing Magic Online, and Magic Online is a piece of crap. So it's just, I mean, if I come home from work and I've worked 8 hours, then I want to play something, and I'm looking at the Magic Online client, I'm like, okay, let's play Hearthstone or something, because I'm just not having fun playing Magic Online. If they could ever get that fixed and actually have a good Magic Online client, I would probably be playing a lot more Magic again. Mm-hmm. But right now, I'm pretty much only playing a lot shortly before the PT events.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, it's definitely good to have you back. I'm just throwing that out there. So, the one last thing I want to talk about is in your Hall of Fame profile, you said something very interesting, and there's a quote from you, and you say, "For a long time, I devoted most of my time to Magic, and to that extent, I don't want to and won't be able to do that again." You had said in an interview as well that you weren't the best student while all of this was happening, and that your studies suffered a little bit during your ride to the top. Looking back on it, do you feel like you missed out on anything because of how much time you were devoting to the game? I kind of got a little bit of bittersweetness from that statement. Like, what was that about?
Not really. I mean, I should have finished my studies differently, but like, I could have easily done that while playing Magic. I mean, maybe I would have had to skip like one or two GPs or something, but I just could have done that a lot more efficiently. But no, I don't regret playing all those Magic tournaments. I had mm-hmm. a very good time. I met amazing people that I'm still friends with and working with a lot of them. So no, that's that came across wrong then.
Mm-hmm. So what are your priorities now as opposed to what they were back then that would sort of keep you from getting that involved in it again?
Well, first of all, given that I'm working in sports betting, I'm working weekends. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, today when we're talking, it's Thursday, and that's my weekend pretty much. Mm-hmm. Most of the European soccer games are on Saturday, Sunday. And, I mean, mostly Saturday, but yeah. Like, I just can't take that much time. I can't take that many weekends off work. I can do it a couple of times in a year, but like, there's no way. I mean, I wouldn't even be interested in playing GPs, to be honest, because it just doesn't seem fun to play 2,500 player tournaments to me. But I would probably play like two or three per year if I could, but like, I just can't get those weekends off. Like, it's already a fight to get the PT weekend. Like, also, I have to get the weekend off work before to play this properly, and it's already a fight to get that time off work. It's just not possible for me to take more time off. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could take more time off, but just not weekends, so.
Right. Definitely. So if anybody's enjoyed your appearance on the show, Kai, how can they get a hold of you? Where can they find you?
I mean, I do have a Facebook page, but I don't really use it, and I only log in like every 2 or 3 weeks because I generally hate Facebook. I use Twitter for work, and Twitter is a very easy way to find me. And like, I mean, I'm checking Twitter, I don't know, a lot per day.
And you're at Kai Buddha, that's your username.
Yeah, it's just Kai Buddha.
Okay. Yeah, I know your Facebook, well, your Facebook was locked because again, I like to stalk my guests and I immediately went to your Facebook and it was locked and it seemed like it was getting a lot of use, so I had to try somewhere else. So I can
There's actually nothing in there. Like my profile is empty, so there's nothing to see there.
Nice.
Like we
So
were thinking about using a Facebook page to test for the next BT, and Matt Sperling was asking me if that empty Facebook page is really me or if that's some imposer, and I'm like, no, that's me.
Kai don't do
No,
Facebook.
not a big fan at least.
Now
Like I only made the Facebook account so I could actually talk to someone that I couldn't really get hold of without using Facebook, but that's the only reason.
a girl.
No, just someone I had to talk to that I hadn't met in a while.
Okay. And the article for Channel Fireball, are you going to be doing more for them? Because I really like reading your stuff.
Well, the thing is, I mean, first of all, now that we're working with Channel Fireball, we're definitely going to give them a bit more content. Whenever someone does well at the PT, we're writing a tournament report. I will try to do something on a monthly basis or so, but I already have a job, and I mean, like writing the tournament report took me a couple of hours. I mean, it's not that easy, and apparently, I still managed to put in a lot of typos. But yeah, so be it. I will try to do something, but it's not going to be on a regular basis. No.
Well, I will make a personal request, and again, I speak for the girls. I would love to see more of your streaming, like when you record your matches. Like, if you could just do that, and maybe read some of the cards in German, we'd really love that. Just.
There's probably a German Magic Online client.
I remember I was actually going through your interviews because there's a couple on YouTube, and there are two that you did all in German. And I remember I was doing them at my parents' house when I was going on. Before I went to GP Richmond, I was staying at my parents' house because they were taking me to the airport and they were cat sitting for me. And I remember I was sitting at my parents' computer watching your interview in German. And my mom was like, "Why are you watching that? You can't understand a thing he's saying." And I'm like, "Shh, he's talking German. Let him talk German." And I just listened to the whole thing and it sounded great. So I don't know what you were saying, but if you want to be German, we will not stop you. Just putting that out there. So.
Probably very unpopular with the people that actually care about the strategic content, but yeah.
We're the audience that really matters, Kai. Just putting that out there. So thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been such a big thrill for me. Like I said, I've enjoyed watching you. I loved watching you at the Pro Tour, and I look forward to whatever you do put out for Channel Fireball, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you. It
Yeah.
was fun.
And if anyone else has enjoyed listening to the show, you can always find the deck to use first and foremost on gatheringmagic.com. The show is also on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Subscribe and leave a positive review. The show is on Twitter at the Deck Tees. I am on Twitter at Original Estrus. And you can also email me personally at estrus@elitistrix.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.